So William the other day had this new shirt and he was very excited about it. And it's one of those shirts that has like the animal body on the shirt, and so your head is like the animal head.
Solid. Right?
He's very excited about this. I wish I could wear those. Yeah. And so he walked in, and I picked him up at the end of the day, and his teacher told me, William came up to me today, and he just looked at her very serious, dead in the eye, and said, "Did you know that my face is the face of a cheetah?" Like, cute. Just dead serious. Yeah. And she's like, "I did know that." And it was very impressive. And he cute. Was very excited about his cheetah shirt. Yeah. That's how he started his week.
They don't make those for adults. They only make like the bikini body, like the fake, like the oversized.
For like old dudes.
Right. Yeah.
All right, well, welcome back to the Beyond Sunday podcast. This is Pastor David Bowser, and with me, as always, is Elise McCarter.
Still here, still pretty successful.
Not with us today is our fellow co-host, Patrick Nazaroff.
Taking a sick day.
He is recovering at home, doing well. Some of you know that we were praying for him over the weekend. He is doing fine, and we'll be back, but just needed an extra day to recoup. So,
yep.
Thank you for all of your prayers out there in podcast world. And Patrick, here's to you. Probably by the time you're hearing this, you're fine. So whatever.
Yeah, we rescind the here's to you.
Our here's to you has been taken back.
Canceled.
Not for you. We're in October. It is beautiful outside.
Spooky
as of
season.
Day of recording, it was like 60 degrees outside this
beautiful.
Morning.
It was,
absolutely gorgeous.
It was 57 when I stepped outside this morning.
That is lovely.
I loved it.
It's still going to be 90 though today, so... That's disappointing. But I've got some news because it is fall. And there are things
fall
that
news.
There are it is this fall news. And there are things that we do in fall. In fact, we have discussed something related to this in the past. Do you remember our discussions of the Sasquatch Festival?
Yes.
Yeah. I think it was in Arkansas somewhere.
Where that sounds right.
Yeah. I looked up the Sasquatch Festival and could not find a Sasquatch Festival in Arkansas. So maybe my memory is flawed. But that sounds like what we had talked about previously. At any rate, as of right now, there is a special contest going on, and you can win the Bronco Sasquatch Searcher, a special Ford Bronco model just for hunting Sasquatch.
Perfect.
I'm going to read some of the benefits, or not benefits. What's it called when you get like extra stuff on your car?
Like at the package.
Yeah, some of the package details. I don't get those things on cars, so I don't know what they're called.
Who knows, yeah.
Does it have brakes? Great. That'll work. All right, so you get a tree camo exterior wrap to blend in with your surroundings as you track the Sasquatch.
Perfect.
A roof-mounted light bar with hood-mounted light pods for tracking in the dark, obviously. Supplemental front and rear-facing cameras and screens to help spot the Sasquatch.
Supplemental, okay.
Yep. Custom upholstered interior for those long tracking sessions. You want to be comfortable. An awning and custom camping chairs for when exploring becomes exhausting. So it like pulls out an awning on the side of the car and you can just sit under the side of the car. A unique console badge and sill plates. I don't know what that is. And a custom Sasquatch badge and puddle light.
Puddle light.
But you can only win this car in a Ford contest. You have to enter the enter the sweepstakes. It's going on, I believe, right now. It started on September 25th. You can still enter to win this one-of-a-kind Bronco Sasquatch Searcher SUV.
Well, obviously, we should do this for a podcast.
Yeah, I think we do need to figure this out. Yeah. Now, if you do not win, rest assured, you can get the Sasquatch package on all other Broncos. It just doesn't come with the tree wrap or the camo tree wrap.
You have to do that yourself.
You have to do that yourself, yeah. So the Sasquatch package is available for all of you Ford Bronco owners out there. Don't sell yourself short. Get the Sasquatch.
First of all, Sasquatch hunters would have a Bronco.
does that just track?
It tracks right? for me. Yeah okay. Exactly. Huh.
I've never ridden in a Bronco. Have you ridden in a Bronco?
Yeah. I had an Uber in New Orleans once it was a Bronco.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was this before or after they re-released the Bronco?
So after they re-released it. Okay. Actually, we had a Bronco when I was in high school. Like a really cool
an OJ
vintage
Bronco.
Yeah. And I loved it. But, you know, it was already old at that point.
Yeah. Do you remember the whole OJ Bronco chase? Were you aware of that at the time?
No.
Oh, it was... So, I mean, you know, the O.J. Simpson
I thought
story.
You were going for O.G. Bronco and
no,
just
no,
let
no,
it
not
slide.
OG.
I was like, he doesn't know. It's okay.
No.
He tries so hard.
I do know what I'm talking about. O.J. Simpson was a football player. According to most people and public opinion, probably.
He murdered his wife, yes.
Yeah, but, correct. You know, was found innocent in a court of law. At any rate, he was fleeing from the police in a white Bronco. And, like, for hours, the news was following him in a camera. And he was just driving, like, 45 down the highway. And the police, like, cleared out the highway. And they're just, like, trailing along behind him. And so, yeah, the Ford Bronco went away for a long time. Because
well, that's the murder
car. They
didn't
really
car.
Want to be associated with that. And, my family at the time, we were flipping back and forth between that and the Chicago Bulls game, if I remember correctly. It was some NBA game. Yeah. I can't promise that it was Chicago Bulls. But time period lines up, it probably would have been.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's another story for another day.
What a wild time.
The Sasquatch package, folks.
The Sasquatch package.
If you were going to get a Sasquatch package on your car, what would your car need in order to be Sasquatch ready? I mean, you already drive a Jeep.
So driving
my
a car, car
would need new tires. Yes. Lifted.
You would need a different car.
I would need a new car. Yeah.
I know. Driving a car to go hunt for Sasquatch seems like... do we think he's not going to notice?
Well, you figure you got to
assuming Sasquatch is a boy.
Sure.
You think he's not going to notice like that wah through the woods? Like,
is that what your car sounds like? I think you need to take
cars,
that in.
Cars in general sound like.
Excellent. <No. laughs> yeah, that's a fair point. But I feel like you also need to get to pretty remote areas. So maybe the vehicle is just to get you into the area and then you've got to like lay low and pull out that awning.
The awning, yeah. And under your tree camouflage awning. I don't know. This just sounds like an excuse to camp for me.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty good excuse.
Yeah.
We're going to go hunt for Sasquatch.
We could probably do worse than to get into Sasquatch.
Yeah. I mean, Yeti, you'd be cold if you're hunting a Yeti.
Exactly.
At least a Sasquatch, you can be in warm places.
Yep. Yeah. You got to choose your myth wisely here.
Yeah. What about a Loch Ness package? Would you like scuba gear
Scotland.
On the side of that? Yeah. That sounds lovely. We could do that. Are there other... cryptids out there that we want to go hunting for? Is that the right term?
Yeah,
right?
Cryptids. Yeah. Let's see.
Yeah, that's probably good. We got the big
those
three.
Those are the big three, yeah.
I mean, Yeti and Sasquatch are basically the same thing in different regions of the world. And then Nessie.
There's also Cthulhu, but that's...
Ooh, what's Cthulhu?
Like the big, like...
You're making arm motions. is
like
it a bird of some sort?
Thing.
Oh, squid?
The eldritch horror.
That was a squid? That's a...
Look it up.
I'm not doubting that. I'm doubting your arm motions, which were clearly indicating eagle, not squid.
Yeah. It's all right.
All right. Let's play charade sometime, and you can be on someone else's team. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. So speaking of things that I'm not certain of what you're doing.
Ambiguity, David.
Ambiguity, yes. Actually, I want to talk about that, too. So I didn't write that down on my notes, but remind me to come back to that.
Okay, ambiguity.
We're going to talk about uncertainty today.
Yes.
And particularly, we're using some material that we're pulling from a podcast called The Hidden Brain. Mm-hmm. On this podcast, it was an episode called Sitting with Uncertainty. It was published at the end of September, I think the 30th of September, just this year. So a fairly recent episode. Host Shankar Vedantam, which I practiced really hard to try to say that correctly. So Shankar, if I'm incorrect, my bad, but I tried.
He's listening. So.
I'm going to tag him when we post this.
Yeah, you should. Did we get it right?
Yeah. Did I do it? Along with his guest, Dr. Donegal Young, who I'm going to call Dr. Young from now on because that's easier to say. And so he had her on because she has done a lot of research to show the contrast between individuals who have what she identifies as a strong desire for certainty versus those with a higher tolerance for uncertainty. Mm-hmm. There's some other categories that go along with that. Within the realm of certainty, we talk about a need for closure. Within the realm of uncertainty, we talk about a high need for cognition. Mm-hmm. And we might get into some of that in a little bit. We'll see. She has her own fascinating story involving improv and travel and medical illnesses and tragedy and all this stuff.
Yep.
That is her story to tell, so we're going to let that sit there. But go and check it out. You can find it wherever podcasts are available. Hidden Brain Podcast, episode Sitting with Uncertainty. But for the moment, I want to start with a little experiment.
Right? Okay.
And you're my guinea pig. Congratulations.
Love that, yes.
Well, I can't experiment on myself because I know the questions that I'm going to ask, so that would be ridiculous.
Okay.
So we're going to test your tolerance for uncertainty.
Okay.
By asking you to describe how comfortable or uncomfortable you are in these various
situations.
In this
moment right now, how uncomfortable am I?
This was not the moment, but sure, why not? Okay. We'll start with that. Yeah, okay. How
should I write things down?
No, it's going to be like a one-line scenario, and you're going to say, how comfortable or uncomfortable would you be?
Okay.
And you can choose how you want to rate it. Like, I'm not going to give you a scale. You can just be, you know, however you want to do it.
Okay, so we'll do 1 through 10.
I mean, I was hoping you'd be funnier than that, but sure, that's you can do 1 through 10.
What scale do you want? The cryptid scale? Yes. By a Sasquatch
from
or a
Sasquatch
Loch Ness?
To whatever this thing was.
Cthulhu.
Yeah, Cthulhu. How uncertain are you? All right, so how comfortable are you with the uncertainty in these various situations?
Okay.
Lost luggage went on a vacation. How comfortable are you?
Oh, it's happened a lot to me. Yeah, yes.
Very comfortable?
Very comfortable.
Okay. A party when you don't know who else was invited. You're going to have to think faster or at least make noise.
That's kind of the nature of parties, unless you yourself are inviting everybody,
oftentimes,
right?
Oftentimes you go to a party and you know who, you know the crowd, you know who's going to be there.
I mean, maybe like a slight discomfort, but for the most part, yeah.
A doctor appointment with a brand new doctor in a brand new location.
Fine, yeah.
You're good with that? Yeah. Okay. An unknown medical diagnosis for a loved one.
Ooh, yeah, less fine.
Less fine?
Yeah.
Okay. So ironically, as I was thinking about these earlier, I don't know if this is actually ironic. I might have misused that just then. But interestingly, I was thinking about these myself earlier. I'm way more comfortable with an unknown medical diagnosis for a loved one than I am with losing my luggage. And I don't know what this says about me.
Yeah, we need to like really dissect this.
I think it's because I spend so much time with people who have these like unknown medical diagnoses.
Okay,
that I'm
so
just
you're
like,
comfortable. Yeah.
I'm just used to it. I'm comfortable in that situation. But I had an encounter, what was it, last Christmas or two Christmases ago, where my luggage did not arrive when we were flying to my in-law's house.
It.
I did not like it at all. I was not a fun person to be around for that 48 hours while I was waiting for my... It was also like winter, and so I like didn't have like... It was just miserable. It was not fun.
So to me, like my luggage not showing up is like, I'm going shopping. Like,
I also hate shopping, so that could that could be a downside. Yeah.
I also don't like shopping, but I love new stuff.
That's an interesting conundrum in which you live.
Yeah. The internet is great for that.
Okay. So the basic thrust that we can take away from this, right, is that we all have different levels of comfort, different thresholds of comfort in various situations. And some situations we're going to be more comfortable with uncertainty, and other situations we're going to be less comfortable. And Dr. Young's kind of point in this is that there are certain patterns that people who are more or less comfortable with uncertainty will tend to follow. And so she will point towards some things with political decision making, that people who tend to lean conservative tend to be less comfortable with uncertainty, and people who would tend to lean progressive or what we might call liberal would tend to be more comfortable with uncertainty. So that's just one realm, right? This is not a surefire fact. She also pointed to like conspiracy theories. If you're more inclined to lean into conspiracy theories, you're probably more, you have a higher desire for certainty, right? Because the conspiracy theory will say this is exactly what happened, rather than an ambiguity of like, hey, evil is in the world and we don't know why bad things happen.
A simple answer.
I would say it gives you the simple answer as opposed to the not simple.
So
those are some of the things that Dr. Young will lay out for us. So just on spec, why don't you react and just kind of tell us your thoughts on this premise of like uncertainty versus certainty and how you deal with that in the world.
Well, I think it's fascinating. I think she also goes into a suggestion. She just touches on it a little bit of how there's this idea that there may be perhaps evolutionary reasons why we might have these differences that, you know, perhaps we are born with kind of this threshold for uncertainty and ambiguity. You know, the person, she even says, the person you want if you are in the jungle getting stalked by a tiger is not somebody who's, you know, super okay with ambiguity and uncertainty, because they're not the one preparing for the eventual attack of this tiger, right? You want that person who really wants certainty because they are preparing for danger.
There's a snap of a twig. I know that I need to get my spear out right now to protect us from danger. Not, I wonder if that twig was a frog. I wonder if that twig was alive when it died. Like, that's not what you're looking for.
So she goes into some really interesting things about, you know, a need for cognition or a desire for cognition for people, and how, you know, your desire to kind of like mull over facts or situations for longer versus like snap decision making, how that can play into also whether or not you enjoy like abstract art or you want like realistic art. You feel like a realistic art person to me. Just saying.
I very much centered with her discussion of Picasso's work.
Yeah, you hate it. Yeah.
I don't know that I had quite the visceral reaction that she did, because I've not like gone expressly to see Picasso, but I also will like look at Picasso and be like, I don't get it. Like, I just don't get it. Like, it doesn't do anything for me. Like, at one point, I do remember this very clearly. I was in middle school, and I went with my parents. We were in San Francisco, and we went to the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and there was an art piece on the wall, and it looked to me to be a blank canvas. And I looked at the name of the painting on the side, and it said, "White Square on White Canvas." And I looked at my dad, and I said, "How is this in a museum?"
Like,
as a seventh grader,
I'm
like, this can't be right. Like, I am not an artist at all. This can't be it. Anyway. So yeah, I'm with you. Yeah. That abstract thing, not my jam.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, this led to, so I actually pitched this podcast episode to you. And it led me down kind of an interesting thought process for myself, right? Like, okay, what is my need for cognition? What is my threshold for ambiguity? What is my need for closure on things? And I think I'm not neatly one box or another, right?
I think that was my biggest frustration with the podcast episode, is that it felt like her research was trying to say people are in a one box or another. And
right.
like, I don't think that's right.
Yeah.
But I see that there are boxes that we right. perhaps float through.
That yeah. feels like a research project that was set up by somebody who needs a lot of closure.
Right. Which
not
she
a
admits
lot of ambiguity.
She did.
Yes. Right. right. But, I think... You know, I am also a pilot, and I'm somebody who enjoys ambiguity
sure.
in art, and I feel like I have these kind of pillars in my life mm-hmm. where, like, I want these things to be solid, and if
yeah.
these things, if I feel solid in these things, then everything else can kind of be in flux around that, and I'm okay.
Yeah.
Once, like, those pillars are not solid, if I feel less steady in those things, then... I'm less okay with the flux and everything else. Mm-hmm, and I'm mm-hmm. looking for other ways to kind of nail that down. And I think one way that like my desire for ambiguity and cognition kind of bumps up against my life is that in being a pilot, there's supposed to be a high level of certainty and closure. Like there,
yes, please.
There are probably very few professions that have a higher level
yeah.
of certainty and closure and less time for high levels of cognition
right.
than being a pilot. And so it's very much against my nature to interact with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was just kind of the first thing that I thought of with that. I was like, that's really interesting because like I am this person in a lot of ways who's like very comfortable with ambiguity and loves time to mull something over.
Mm-hmm.
I'll mull forever.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also actively engage in and enjoy a thing that requires me to just like snap decision making
yeah.
and get it right.
Sure.
So
maybe let's take the next logical progression of the step, right? Mm-hmm. And say how do we see this impacting or interacting, is probably a better word, with our faith and
mm-hmm.
with expression
yep.
of the faith, right?
Yep.
'Cause that is an aspect that she touched on, right? She kind of leaned into her own journey with her husband's diagnosis and things
mm-hmm.
like that, but it was not a central component of
sure.
her
yep.
Research, which is totally fine. She
yep.
doesn't have to do our work for us. We can have this conversation.
Yep.
So uncertainty within the context of faith is... comfort with uncertainty, right? Is that kind of base threshold of being comfortable with uncertainty? Is that helpful to our faith or is it a hindrance to our faith?
Oh, yeah. So I think for like on a personal note, I think it's incredibly helpful to understand that and to be able to call that out and interact with it. I think faith as an institution has not found the idea of ambiguity helpful, or they have
mm-hmm.
at least at a minimum not mined that for its possibilities,
yeah.
right?
And yeah.
I think, you know, we joked about talking about fundamentalism before this podcast, and here we go.
our monthly callback.
I know. It's like a broken record. If there's one certainty, it's that we're going to talk about fundamentalism at some point.
At some point. There it is.
Yeah. So you can look at more, you know, legalistic or fundamentalist sects of faith, right? And they thrive. Their whole setup thrives
yeah.
on a high degree of certainty, saying
yes.
like, this is right, this is wrong, this is how it happened, this is what the Bible says. Anything outside of that is, you know, it's just simply not true. Like
yeah.
you have to subscribe to these things, and it simplifies
mm-hmm.
what otherwise is a very complex world, right?
Yeah.
And people who are drawn to those types of beliefs thrive on a high level of certainty, right? And
yeah.
that's very comforting to them to have that box around faith.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to go back to what you were talking about with the pillars, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think for so many people, the certainty in the realm of faith is a pillar that they want to hold on to say, this is the thing that never changes
mm-hmm.
so that I can handle everything else that's changing
right.
in the world,
yep.
right? And so for you, right, the pillar of the certainty within a cockpit of a plane maybe
mm-hmm.
is the thing that you hold on to, whereas you're very comfortable, you know, letting everything else kind of fluctuate around you.
Right.
And they're kind of almost like the inverse, you know,
right.
they're not all pilots, but you get the idea, right?
Right.
And I just think that's a really interesting component because it's not how I see faith or the world. And I remember this conversation that I had with a couple when I was in South Carolina. And our congregation at the time was, it was 2015. So the Supreme Court had just kind of legalized same-sex marriage
mm-hmm.
across the board. And so our congregation was wrestling with what were we going to do, or were we going to allow same-sex weddings
mm-hmm.
In our building.
Mm-hmm.
And this was an ongoing issue. And so this couple came in to talk to me about this decision that was facing the congregation. And I remember them looking at me and saying, we just want the church to hand down a teaching that says this is what the ELCA believes is right and this is what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we just want the ELCA to do that. And in my head, I didn't say this, but in my head, I'm like, what you want is a pope, and that's Catholicism.
Right,
right.
Do
and
your work for you.
That's not how the ELCA works, right?
Mm-hmm.
The ELCA really lives much more in some of this uncertain space. Even our now pretty well dated social statement on human sexuality from 2009 was living in the space of saying, okay, there are people in the ELCA who are all across this spectrum of how we understand this issue, and we can all be faithful people together. Like that was kind of the thrust of the statement, is saying that there has to be this room for uncertainty for us to wrestle with that and for us to be okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really hard for people to pin something that has felt certain for so long and allow there to be uncertainty in that space.
Yep.
And that's a real challenge. And, you know, that slippery slope argument of, well, if you do this and then it's going to be that, right? Mm-hmm. I think that comes from that uncertainty, just kind of letting it spin out of control, in the same way that perhaps you sit at a hospital with your, you know, loved one and they say, well, we have a mass that we don't know what it is. And you immediately start spinning out of, what if it's cancer? What if it's terminal? What if it's, right?
Yep.
As opposed to saying, okay, there's a mass and we're going to take this next step and we're going to figure out what it is, right? Yeah, it's a different way of interacting with that process. So as we think about this, let's think about the Bible for a few minutes, because that's a part of our...
That's part of what we do, ostensibly. Yeah.
And so I think there are some characters that perhaps we can draw on to contemplate this a little bit. So when we think about certainty versus uncertainty within Scripture, I'm personally immediately thinking of Pharisees versus Jesus.
Okay,
And so I think, you know, Pharisees and living out their kind of Pharisaic law, we're saying, this is right, this is wrong, here's the boundary, done.
Yeah.
And Jesus, right, through the Sermon on the Mount, through his interactions with people, was constantly saying, this is not as clear cut as you think it is.
Right.
And there were definitely things that Jesus was always certain about, right?
Right.
But there was a lot more area for ambiguity than the Pharisees were perhaps allowing room for. And so this is where I want to get into that word ambiguity.
Yes.
Because you brought this up, and that I found that to be, in the podcast, a more helpful term than uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about ambiguity as you understood it within the context of this conversation.
In the context of this conversation, or?
I mean, of the podcast, what we're talking about.
Okay, so when she's talking about ambiguity, she gives a couple of examples, right? So we already touched on like abstract art, for one thing.
Right.
It's like, it's not necessarily clearly any one thing.
Yeah.
It could be many different things depending on who's looking at it and what you're bringing to the table, right? Also, stories that don't follow kind of traditional paths and are not really neatly tied up in a bow at the end, which is something that I have maybe more insight and experience on there. Like those kind of things are, you know, that's ambiguity, right? Because you cannot say, and this is definitely what happened. This is definitely what this is. This is the same for every person that reads this. This is the same experience for every person that looks at this painting, right?
Yeah.
It is not. So that's kind of, I think, what she's getting at with ambiguity. Whether or not you enjoy that or find it frustrating or stressful.
Yeah, and I found that term much more helpful than uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
Because uncertainty, for me, particularly when we contrast certainty with uncertainty in the context of faith, it feels like you're wrestling with that faith versus doubt thing.
Or like you can't make a decision is what I hear with uncertainty.
Yeah.
Like I just cannot decide.
Yeah. Versus ambiguity. I'm like, okay, there are things that I hold central and there's the world in which there are ambiguous things, right? There are things that I don't fully understand. There are things that I can't yet comprehend.
Right.
And how comfortable am I in those spaces, right?
Yeah.
If we go back to, those silly examples that I was giving earlier, if I'm invited to a party and I don't have any idea who else is going to be there, well, that's ambiguous as to what the social situation is going to be like.
Right.
Am I comfortable going into an ambiguous situation like that? Or
Are
am
you?
I? Usually. Listen, I'm not on trial here, all right?
No, you ask me these questions. only fair.
That is only fair. I would be more comfortable if it were a professional environment. Where I had no idea who was going to be there, but I knew I was expected to be there as pastor.
That would be way more stressful to me.
I would be, but I know what role I'm supposed to play, right?
Okay.
Regardless of who's in the room, I know this is what I'm supposed to be.
Right. And this is like your lane, your thing.
Right.
Yeah.
But if I'm going and it's a room, I don't have any idea who's going to be there. Well, am I supposed to be pastor? Am I supposed to just be casual? Like, and that's
harder. That's a whole other kettle of fish.
It's a whole,
another podcast episode later.
I think that's another series. That's Pastor David's therapy sessions.
Right.
Now I completely lost where I was going. I just found ambiguity to be a more helpful term. So if you're out there listening, this was the point, and you're struggling with this idea of uncertainty, try ambiguity on for size. Because I think for me that was really helpful, because what Jesus does is he tells stories and parables where things are ambiguous.
Purposely ambiguous.
Jesus teaches in ways that says, listen, there's a father who loves these sons, and these sons both come back, but Jesus doesn't at the end say which son was right, which son was wrong, mm-hmm. or who the father loved more, right? He just leaves this open to say, well, you can take this in a lot of mm-hmm. different directions, right? You can hear, it's almost abstract art in
yes,
some ways.
Yep.
But it's not Pablo Picasso. So
because that's horrible, you think? Yeah. No. Terrible, bad, and wrong.
No. Well, this is what I do find fascinating about myself, a little in, further insight into Pastor David's mind. I really do find that I'm comfortable with ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
I do not like abstract art.
Yeah. I think you like your ambiguity in certain places. Like,
which is probably true for all of us. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you probably have your own pillars that are different than what mine might be. Yeah. But, yeah.
And I don't know that I look to art to say I need everything to be the same all the mm-hmm. time.
Yeah.
I just don't get abstract art. But, like, improvisational jazz or stories that don't end in, consistent ways or follow mm-hmm. consistent, I'm fine with those. I think that can be great. I don't know. I just don't do abstract art. It's just not my thing.
Yeah.
That's fine.
And I think it's...
It's not the end all.
One of the kind of things that she touched on, too, in this podcast was, like, if you are somebody who likes, like, a regular work schedule and thinks suits their personality, mm-hmm. like, that is a sign that you're leaning more into certainty in that area, at least. And I have realized a long time ago that I would go insane if I had regular 9 to 5 hours every week. Like, that just does not work for...
There are weeks when it feels like having a regular podcast to record for 1 hour a week is, like, driving you up a wall.
Yeah, this is... it's always on Wednesdays. It's these same two people. No, I like it. I wouldn't say this is one of my, like, overall pillars, but it is a thing that I plan my week around, so there's that.
Well, happy to be your hinge point for your schedule.
Yeah. Right.
All right, so we've got the Pharisees certain, no room for ambiguity, right?
Right.
This is the law, this is what's right, this is what's wrong.
A little, just for anybody who might be listening who's not intimately familiar with what a Pharisee is, do a little rundown for us.
Sure. Pharisees were religious leaders of the day in Jesus' time, right? So in the Gospels, they're kind of like lifted up as Jesus' foils, mm-hmm. right? The Pharisees are not the ones who ultimately have Jesus arrested and brought in another group called the Sadducees. That's not important for this. But the Pharisees were like your everyday local pastors in your area. They mm-hmm. were the guys that you knew who were, they're teaching you how to be Jewish, how to follow God, right? Mm-hmm. That was their job. And they had a very clear understanding of these were the laws, this is what you're supposed to do to follow them. And Jesus kind of came in and blew that all up. And then in good Jewish tradition, right, Jesus teaches in these very ambiguous stories, right? Mm-hmm. Jesus is following a pattern of parables that far predates him from other mm-hmm. Famous rabbis that came before him. And Jesus is continuing that pattern, but it was something that we don't see lifted up as the way the Pharisees were thinking.
Right.
And interestingly, you talked about the stories that end in a unique way. The original ending to the Gospel of Mark, right? We have like two bonus endings. If you read Mark in a modern Bible, it'll say, Mark will end, and then it'll say the shorter ending, and then it'll say the longer ending. Mm-hmm. And so the original ending is that first part before the shorter ending, and it ends with Jesus is crucified, and Jesus is dead, and the disciples say nothing to anyone because they're afraid. And that's where it stops.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's where we believe the original gospel ended, and then there are these two other endings that are added on to it mm-hmm. because people are not maybe comfortable with it.
Right. Like, wait a minute.
That can't be where it ends.
Right.
Anyway, so that's leaning into that. Now, so we take Pharisees, we take Jesus, and then we look into what I think we have as kind of a modern parallel to this mm-hmm. of modern evangelicals
uh-huh.
and modern mainline Protestants, for lack of a better term.
Okay.
And I think your modern evangelicals will tend to, broad brush strokes, tend to align more along the line of the Pharisees with that high need for certainty,
yes,
as you kind of leaned into earlier, versus some of our mainline Protestants, where we tend to have more comfort with ambiguity and uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are certainly things where a lot of mainline Protestants still say this is right and this is wrong and that's
sure,
it.
Sure, yeah.
But there's also a lot more room within the mainline Protestantism to say, well, scripture was interpreted this way, or mm-hmm. scripture was interpreted this way, or scripture has, the interpretation of scripture has shifted as the Spirit continues to move, right? There's more tolerance for that. So maybe my question for you as an outsider to that,
mm-hmm.
not to the world, but like not someone who spends their work day thinking about this sort
right,
of thing.
Yep.
How does that impact your ability to interact with your faith on a day-to-day basis, if at all?
The difference between modern evangelicals and mainline Protestants, or
more the difference between that certainty and that ambiguity? Like, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I think we can all assess, right? You tend to lean into the ambiguous. You're comfortable with that.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
certainly align with Lord of Life. And I think Lord of Life, typically we're comfortable with
ambiguity
in a lot of ways. Not everywhere, right?
Sure. Yeah.
You know, our finances, we want that to be pretty black and white. We don't want a lot of ambiguity there.
Right.
We want to know
things tend to go better when you have a good handle on the details in certain areas. Yeah. It's like, for me, it seems to be a question in faith in particular of how comfortable are you with somebody else's experience being different from yours?
Mm. Wow. Yeah.
And I, you know, I grew up in a more evangelical tradition, right?
Yeah.
That was more Presbyterian. So not like all the way heavy on the certainty, but more so for sure than the ELCA is. And so I'm familiar with that. And I had this experience of kind of like stepping outside of a box, right? You know, I think my perspective has definitely shifted on, you know, I am now quite comfortable with somebody else's experience being different from mine. To me, I don't see that as a threat to my faith if your experience of your faith or lack of faith or, you know, whatever you identify with is different from what I would say mine is.
Thank you for acknowledging my lack of faith. I appreciate that.
I'm just calling it out. I mean, there's room, right?
I mean, you were pointing right at me when you said it, so it felt a little accusatory. But that's
it was a flat hand point, yours.
That's right.
If you had a lack of faith.
The ambiguous you. That's,
right, yeah. The Catholic you.
So let me ask this. How do you, in your experience, how did you come to that place where you're more comfortable acknowledging that I'm comfortable with other people's experience being different than my own?
I think it's the more you know thing, right? Like the more you get outside. The more you get outside of your bubble and your box, and the more you talk to other people, the more, well, really more you listen to other people, the more you, and different types of people, which I think is crucial. The more you have an opportunity to understand that, you know, everybody else's life looks quite different from mine, and that we all bring different things to this conversation.
Yeah.
We're all having this conversation.
Yeah.
You know, we're all having the same conversation, just with different things to add.
Yeah. I think that's really beautiful. You know, the metaphor that's coming to my head as you're talking about this is building a house, right? Or actually not building, remodeling a house. Because I think for many of us, a house has been built around us, right? And sometimes we've had a part in that. But oftentimes, I think we've kind of decorated a house after it was built for us in our very early years, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're brought in a particular community, in a particular way of thinking, in a particular way of being educated. And you have this house that's around you. And you're kind of like, oh, well, I'm going to put this picture over here. And I'm going to put this picture over here.
Yeah.
But there comes a point where you're like, I want to remodel this house, right? I want a new kitchen.
Yep.
And the little bit that I know about remodeling, which is very little, but the little bit that I know is that sometimes you don't know what actually matters until you start tearing down walls.
Right. Is this load bearing?
Right. Exactly. That's the question, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Is this a load bearing thing? You don't know. Is this a load bearing thing until you start tearing things down? And so, like, I can say for myself, right? I've talked about this on the podcast before. I talked about this in a sermon a couple of weeks ago, right? I did not always see all people as welcome in the church. And I thought that that was a load-bearing belief until suddenly I started to pry at that and started to tear down some drywall and started to knock out some 2x4s and recognized, hey, look at that. The house didn't come crumbling down around me.
Right.
All right. This was something that I could understand differently and I could think now I'm fairly confident all people are welcome is a load-bearing thing for me, right? Like
this
is the thing that I'm like, this is a core principle where I'm certain of this. And there are some ambiguities that come out of that I don't know how to deal with all the time.
Yeah.
But this core thing can be a certainty. And so I think there's an element of like, what is our willingness to go in and start busting up a wall to see if it's really load-bearing or not, right? Because the other thing that I've learned about construction and remodeling is that you can always fix a wall, right?
Right.
Right. If you get in there and you're like, this thing was remodeled or was load bearing. Okay, we can put that back, right?
we can
repair this, right? Hopefully you notice before the whole thing comes crumbling down,
yeah.
right? And so what is our willingness to enter into that space? And unfortunately, this is the hard part. And I think, unfortunately, in order to be willing to do that work, you already have to have a tolerance for the ambiguity.
Yes.
And so there's a part of me that wonders, like, if I'm just not someone who has a high tolerance for ambiguity, what do I need to do to start that work? And, right. I don't know that I have an answer, because I feel like I have a fairly high tolerance for ambiguity. But I'll leave that open for a point of conversation for us here.
I wonder if maybe it is finding your pillars, right?
Mm-hmm.
And shifting, being open to shifting what your pillars are.
Your
load-bearing pillars. Like what, you know, maybe that has always been certain black and white tenets of a particular denomination.
Sure.
But what happens if you shift that a little bit?
Yeah.
You know, and then you still have certainty. You still have things that make you feel grounded, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what if those things change?
Yeah. Yeah. That's beautiful.
Well
done.
Oh, thank you.
So, all right, one last question for us to, to kind of wrap up here. Is there a time, and we're going to exclude piloting from this because that's not fair. Is there a time when uncertainty or ambiguity is unhelpful to our faith?
Unhelpful to our faith. I think that people certainly experience times of uncertainty or ambiguity in the form of doubt as unhelpful, right? I would argue that it is actually helpful to the whole.
Yeah. Do you think that's part of the tearing down of a wall? Like,
yes.
Like, do you feel like sometimes like a wall is busted out in front of you and you didn't get to choose it, and so you feel like that's really unhelpful?
Yeah, and I think anybody who's ever remodeled a house knows that at some point in that process you get to a point where you say, what have I done?
Yeah.
Like, why did I want to do this? I liked that wall there.
That was the best place for that wall.
I was fine with this not being open concept.
That's right.
Like, HGTV got in here and influenced me.
Blast you, Property Brothers.
Right, yeah. And so then it becomes like, well, what if we need to go back and put this wall back real quick so that, you know, I'm more comfortable again, or so I don't have to reevaluate this whole thing. But I think that, you know, ultimately something like faith is stronger for you moving through that ambiguity and that doubt, right?
Yeah.
Because then you can circle back to that later and be like, no, I've been in that valley. Like, I stood in the middle of that busted out empty house and I still found the studs and the load bearing pillars, right?
Yeah.
Like, I still found those things.
Yeah.
They just maybe were in a different place than I thought they were.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm reminded of Jesus here, you know, in the garden before he goes to the cross, right? Praying out to God, if there's another way, you know, let me get out of this.
Yeah.
But not my will, but yours, right?
Yeah.
And that reminder that Jesus in that moment, I don't know if I would call it uncertainty, but at least, you know, praying for there to be a different option, praying for relief from what he was so concerned about.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I'd classify it quite as uncertainty or as doubt, but that willingness to like stand in that really difficult space and say, the only thing I can do is trust that you want that wall to be gone.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, I think we also forget that Jesus was also human, right?
Right.
And
so I think that's a very human expression.
He had a brain that probably gave him some anxiety sometimes. And, you know, that's all the brain chemicals that we have as human beings.
Yeah.
I don't think Jesus was immune from those.
Oh, that's an interesting. All right. That's a whole nother. Yeah. Was Jesus immune to brain chemicals?
Speaking of hidden brain.
I can't get into that one.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, this was fun.
It was.
Yeah.
It's a good one. I know you were worried about this one.
It was just a lot of uncertainty going into it.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
we'll kick Patrick off more often. Hey, if you enjoyed this episode, you, of course, can send us an email at beyondsundaypodcast.com and send us all your favorite things that we do when Patrick's not here. We'd love to hear about those. beyondsundaypodcast@gmail.com. And then, of course, find all of our episodes at beyondsundaypodcast.com and check out the Hidden Braden podcast, their episode Sitting with Uncertainty, published on September 30th.
Mm-hmm.
I think Patrick says a thing here, right?
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week with more Beyond Sunday.